From TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing to say things to you on the radio instead. Back on the show this week is Observer editor Dave Mann. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you.
And joining us via the miracle of telephonic communication is Observer staff writer Emily DePrang. Emily, how's the weather in Houston?
It is gross.
sounds like things are normal then. Everything's good.
It's normal.
Later on in the show, we will be joined by Julia Trigg Crawford, a farmer near Paris, Texas, who has sued TransCanada for what she says is an abuse of eminent domain power in the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. We'll also be joined by Shannon Young, a freelance journalist in Mexico, who will discuss the ramifications of Mexico's recent decision to open its energy sector to private and foreign interests. But first, we have other news to discuss. Dave, Emily, we've been discussing gubernatorial candidate Wendy Davis a lot on the show recently, and it's another week. Time for another update, I think.
Yeah, and we've been talking about her campaign a lot in the office, too.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah. I think everybody has. I mean, I think it's been a big topic of conversation all across the state. I mean, it's been a fascinating 2 weeks, not only for, you know, political junkies, but I think for just about everybody. I mean, I think the news this week was that Wendy Davis was finally kind of pushing back against the criticisms and investigations into her life story. On Tuesday night, she gave a big speech at a fundraiser here in Travis County where she kind of, quote unquote, set the record straight on her life story and kind of laid out her narrative and kind of pushed back against this idea that she had abandoned her kids and had lost custody of her kids and had kind of put her own ambition ahead of her family. And basically, you know, the insinuation from a lot of people on the right was that she was a bad mother. I mean, that was kind of the narrative they were constructing.
Right.
And they've said a lot of other bad things about her as well. And I think her campaign, for the most part, had kind of let that go and hadn't really pushed back very forcefully. And on Tuesday, she gave that big speech, kind of responding to it and saying, look, I always put my family first. And my story is about somebody who, you know, went after education and reached for the highest level to try to make a better life for her family. It was all about my family.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that 2 week delay was because they were trying to figure out their messaging strategy, or what was that about?
I have no idea, and I wish I knew because I
have a theory.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it seems like if there's a big conversation about whether there's a war on women, and you have a successful woman who is running and who has been attacked, you know, called an abortion Barbie and these sort of gendered attacks on her, then, you know, it seems incredibly backwards to come out and say that she's a bad mom. Well, that just seems like an extremely sexist and sort of obviously sexist attack. And so I would have thought that the delay would have been because it's like, all right, sit back and let you guys sound like you're from the 50s. But maybe if that wasn't having as negative effect as maybe they thought it should, because this is Texas, then maybe that was why it was time to come out and say something about it.
Well, I think that they definitely underestimated the damage that was being done by this. And I think that I agree with you that they could have just let it go if it was only people on the right kind of going on with this. I mean, but it did start with the Dallas Morning News story, which has been hotly debated about, you know, whether that was sensationalized or not, but it did raise some factual issues about her biography or whether she had glossed over certain details. I mean, there were factual things there that I think needed to be responded to, and other media outlets picked up on it and ran with it, and it just kind of exploded, and they didn't really respond. And I think, they didn't respond in a forceful way. And to me, I don't know why, but I do think it's been damaging. It kind of reminds me of what John Kerry did in the presidential race in 2000. And maybe that's ironic because people are saying that Wendy Davis was swift-boated, and I don't know if that's a good analogy or not. But I do know that John Kerry...
Her strength being used against her.
Yeah, exactly. And I think John Kerry kind of sat there and let the swift-boat attacks go unresponded to for like a week or 2 weeks. I don't remember how long it was, but it was long enough to let those things penetrate and do damage before they really push back. And by that time, I think it was too late to push back. Then it never really got undone. And I think you're seeing the same thing here with Wendy Davis, where, you know, the idea that she quote unquote lied about her biography, which is not true. I mean, I don't think you can look at the facts and say she lied, but right. that is the narrative that's developing out there for whatever reason, incorrectly. And because they didn't respond and they just sat there for like 11 days kind of without a real pushback. And finally on Tuesday, she gave this speech. Her daughters came out and wrote open letters responding to the criticism. So finally had this pushback, but I do wonder if it was too late. And by the time they did that pushback, you know, I think this narrative has started to settle in and we'll see what happens. But, you know, there is a possibility that the damage has already been done to her campaign.
Isn't it a little early to say the damage has been done? I mean, she's got a lot more going for her than how long she lived in a trailer park.
Oh, I agree. And I'm not saying that the election's over, she's unelectable, but I think her campaign took on water in these last 10 days. And, there are people out there who maybe would have voted for her who are starting to get this message that, oh, she lied about her biography. And if she wants to get those votes, she's going to have to get past that. And of course, there's a lot of time between now and election day. We've got whatever it is, 10 months. So there's plenty of time to kind of rectify it. But I do think that her candidacy has probably been damaged a little bit with some voters out there that she's going to have to make up.
And from there, we go to a story in your neck of the woods, Emily. Tell me about what's going on in Harris County jails.
Well, what's going on is a debate over whether or not there's anything going on. So the Harris County Jail has a huge problem with inmate-on-inmate sexual violence, this is not an allegation that's been made, but the only explanation I can come up with is there's a conspiracy at the Department of Justice to make it seem that way. So last July, the Justice Department study came out, and it's this huge study. It was looking at over the course of 3 years, 2009 through 2011, and it had surveyed over 350 jails all over the country, and it had also done all these prisons. It's just as comprehensive as it gets. It's the federal government responding to the to this 2003 act, that the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It's just as official as this data gets. And what they did was they went into all these jails and they administered jails and prisons and, I mean, immigration facilities, Indian Territory, everything. And they administered these these anonymous surveys to the inmates, asking them this very specific stuff. Lots of demographic information, information about every kind and variation of, I mean, everything down to their height and their weight and their orientation and just all of this information, and also all this information about whether or not in the past year they had experienced any of these different kinds of sexual harassment or abuse.
And in Harris County, that number was high?
Harris County, that number was, Harris County came in third of those, of more than 350, I think it was 352 jails surveyed. And Harris County had the third highest rate.
The third nationally.
Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very big deal. And, the Harris County Sheriff's Office, this jail is the biggest in Texas. It's the third largest in the nation. And it also has this really high rate. And, a high rate in a huge facility means a great number of people being affected.
Right.
The rate of sexual violence inmate on inmate, and this is in a given year. This is not like if you're in the jail for 20 years, does this thing happen to you once? This is in a given year. And their rate was 6.3%.
But now that we have that information, we can solve the problem, right?
You would think that. But, the Department of Justice held these hearings, and the sheriff was, first he was sent these questions, asking, to explain this rate, and asking him, the specific question was, what are the factors that led to the high incidence of sexual victimization? And Garcia wrote back, there was and is no high incidence of sexual victimization in the Harris County jail facilities.
Aha.
And so he goes on to give this really really contradictory explanations of how, well, there's not a high rate, there's a flaw with the study, but even if there were a high rate, it would be because we have these certain populations. And, you know, then he gave this testimony.
So he didn't really agree that there even was a problem.
No, he had a jail that had,
according to the Department of Justice, the third highest rate of sexual assault in the country.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't even agree that, there's no problem.
There's not a problem here.
He straight up said there was not a problem. Like, flat out. Like, complete sentence. And then he went on, there were these explanations, and basically they said and then he was called in, and he had to give testimony earlier this month.
Right.
To the Justice Department, and his testimony was entirely, you know, he said briefly, like, I don't believe the study, but let's just call this an opportunity for learning, and here's all the stuff that we've done in the last 2 years to make this not happen. But the thing is, no matter what you can do 50 things to make something not happen, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen or it wasn't happening. It's like his explanation was that there's not a problem because there really shouldn't be a problem because we have this hotline and we have these posters and we have these pamphlets.
Right.
And there's this video people watch. I'm going to use a technical term. It sucks because there was a new study came out just a few days ago that was not looking at these anonymous survey results. It was looking at just the official reports, the official allegations of sexual assault. And Harris County, over these 3 years, 2009 through 2011, Harris County had more allegations of sexual assault, not just harassment or anything else, but actual non-consensual sexual acts, so rape. They had more official allegations of that than the rest of the jails in Texas, the county jails combined.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
Emily,
it's a huge jail, but it's out of control.
Well, I assume you'll be following this story closely.
Yes, I will.
Well, I look forward to some more updates and hopefully some positive news. Thanks for sharing these stories, guys.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. And joining us from Mexico is freelance journalist Shannon Young, who has a piece about the privatization of Mexico's energy sector appearing on texasobserver.org very soon. Shannon, good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us sort of a summation of your story?
Sure. Well, some of it is just the basic background about Pemex, Mexico's national oil company, the role that it plays in Mexico's economy, and the way the process occurred legislatively to open up Mexico's hydrocarbon sector to foreign companies. Now, this is the first time since 1938, the oil expropriation of 1938, that foreign companies have been able to come back into Mexico and profit off of the country's extensive hydrocarbons reserves. So it's important in that sense. And in another sense, one that's more germane to Texas, is how interests in energy companies based in Texas are involved in, or how they stand to profit from this process of opening up the country to foreign investment in the energy sector. I will say that because of public opinion against the privatization of Pemex or of the hydrocarbons reserves, that politicians that were supporting energy reform were very careful to not use the word privatization other than to say this is not a privatization of Pemex. What it essentially is that Pemex will have to compete with other big oil companies to exploit the hydrocarbons reserves. And as of now, and since 1938, Pemex pretty much had the exclusive license to be able to do it. They were the only, it was the only company that could extract and capitalize off of Mexico's oil reserves. Now, there were some contractors who provide oil field services, but as far as like a company that sells it directly to the consumer, that takes it out at the wellhead and sells it directly to the consumer. That's the exclusive domain of Pemex, and that's about to change.
So now that that's no longer exclusive, what has the reaction been from the people?
It's pretty controversial. Now, of course, you know, not everyone is you know, involved in politics, but those who do watch this particular issue feel pretty strongly about it, because Pemex not only is a source of national pride, a symbol of financial sovereignty, but it's also the cornerstone of the Mexican economy. It's important to note that the federal budget, 40% of the federal budget comes from Pemex. Most of Pemex's profits go back into the national coffers, and Pemex is the second most profitable company in Latin America. So we're talking about billions of dollars a year here.
Sure.
And of course, you know, Mexico has, like the U.S., a public school system, but it's financed at the federal level, and it has a public health care system as well as a extensive bureaucracy of, you know, fairly stable middle class jobs. Infrastructure projects and all that. And of course, Pemex contributes a lion's share to the financing of these projects and these social services.
And so how is that likely to change now?
Well, that's something that remains to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another
right,
part
because this,
of this...
This change happened very recently.
Yeah, it was signed into law, I believe, the 21st of December and mm-hmm. in late December. And it still has to go through a process of what's known here as secondary legislation, which is kind of the fine-tuning and definition, you know, nuts and bolts of the legislation. So they'll work out, like, the details of licensing and whatnot in this secondary round, which is coming up in February.
Mm-hmm.
So things, you know, we don't see ExxonMobil immediately, you know, extracting oil or opening up gas stations here in Mexico, but it's something that is coming fairly soon, and the legal framework for it is already in place. They had to change a part of the Mexican Constitution, actually, to implement this
Whoa.
Energy reform, because the Constitution states that the federal government is the sole owner of mineral rights here in Mexico.
Shannon, go ahead.
Go ahead.
What I wonder is, you know, what's their motivation? I mean, it obviously was a huge and dramatic change, and like you said, altering the Constitution, but somebody is going to make a lot of money off this. I'm just wondering who it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, profit is the motivation. And you'll see another aspect of this article was the one-sided coverage that this received in the U.S. And if you are to take the U.S. media at its word, or the coverage and the experts that, you know, provided opinions in this coverage, if you're to take them at their word, it seems like a win-win situation, or it's portrayed as a win-win situation for both foreign energy companies who now have a chance to come into the Mexican market, and for the citizens of Mexico who, under law, are still the sole owners of oil in the ground. Doing the accounting, it remains to be seen. And, of course, there's a legitimate fear that once you put Pemex into direct competition with some of the largest oil companies in the world, Pemex is going to lose out. And
right.
If you're talking about the number one source of revenue in Mexico, you're talking about a central piece of the Mexican economy. And as mm-hmm. I said earlier, this finances the social services system, healthcare, education, infrastructure, the bureaucracy, you know, you name it, as far as government services goes, Pemex provides a huge amount of the funding for it. So once you start tinkering with the source of revenue, you know, it's kind of an experiment that Mexico's about to enter into.
We have time for about one more question. Dave, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, I was wondering, why the Mexican government would go in for that? What's the motivation? What was their argument for why this would be a good thing?
Well, the argument is, of course, that it will benefit Mexico as well. Another argument was that, well, Pemex is this hopelessly corrupt ailing dinosaur of a company that needs to be reformed. And if you look at the actual numbers, like I said earlier, that's the second most profitable company in Latin America, it's still doing pretty well.
Right.
And this legislation doesn't really do anything to correct the corruption that is within Pemex, because, of course, there is an amount of kleptocracy involved when you're dealing with a company that's this profitable, especially in a country that's been under one party, was under one party rule for so long, and now has returned to the president is now of that same party that ruled Mexico for more than 70 years. Government accountability is pretty lame here, and so there's a lot of politicians making money off of Pemex, and it stands to reason that people who, or if you look at other countries that have denationalized some important industries, in context of government corruption, you also can see how politicians themselves or relatives of politicians end up getting some pretty juicy deals out of the denationalization matter. So,
yeah, that's kind of what it sounded like to me.
I mean,
but I didn't know.
Still, it remains
paranoid.
To be seen. But there's certainly potential for this kind of corruption to occur.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show by the folks at the Texas Observer. Last week, the Texas segment of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline started flowing. Texas Pipeline Watch, a group of landowners and activists, have vowed to watch the pipeline like a hawk and document everything they see on the group's Facebook page. Joining us now is one of those landowners, Julia Trigg Crawford, who runs the Red Ark Farm near Paris, Texas. She has gone through a series of appeals in her legal battle with TransCanada. She says the Keystone XL pipeline abuses eminent domain. Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jonathan, for having me.
Julia, how have things changed for you since the Texas segment started flowing, or have they?
Well, I haven't seen, you know, anything curdling out of the ground, and there's, you know, my water still, it looks like the way it was the week before, but, you know, I know that stuff is coursing through my land, and I'm fearful that something might happen. That's why I'm out every day and taking pictures and checking thermometers and, you know, looking for telltale signs.
What kind of signs?
Well, you know, anything that looks out of the normal.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like asking, what does a disaster look like? Well, it looks different than things were, you know, on the status quo. But we know that, you know, PHMSA, which is the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, which is the watchdog group that's supposed to make sure the pipelines are constructed carefully, they did a multi-year study, and they say that in spite of all the high technology remote sensing and data collection that the pipeline companies have to watch pipelines, 80% of spills and leaks are found by the landowners or people who are on the ground, workers from the pipeline. So
this has led to Texas Pipeline Watch?
That's pretty much the genesis of the Pipeline Watch, is that we know that it's on our shoulders and our boots need to be on the ground to watch this thing, not just because it's our land, but our neighbor's land or our neighbor's neighbor's land.
What kind of things have you guys shared on the Facebook? I took a cursory look, but I'm sure that some of our listeners have not.
Well, we have a Facebook page, and we also have a website. And knowing that when the first Keystone started up in, 2010, there were like 14 leaks in 14 months.
Mm-hmm.
And the vast majority of those leaks were near the pumping stations. These are the stations that look like big industrial complexes that, I guess, push the product along by increasing the pressure or providing some, you know, pressure behind it. So I actually drove to the nearest pumping station from my house. It's over in Delta County, between Paris and Sulphur Springs. And while that particular pumping station wasn't running, because it's designed only for, it will only be used once tar sands start flowing, the gate was unlocked. So I got to call TransCanada's emergency number and tell them that a pumping station was unlocked and that I would stay there until someone responded, and it was 4 hours before someone could get there to lock the gate behind me. So you know what? Eyes on the ground doesn't necessarily always mean looking for oil. It means watching every piece of this process, because if a company is leaving gates unlocked at big facilities, who knows what other things they're overlooking.
Well, Julia, I was wondering, just a little bit of the history of this. and how they came to build a pipeline across your land. And I take it that they didn't gain your permission before they came through and built this pipeline?
Not only did they not gain our permission, we told them that we didn't want them at all. In 2008, when my dad was the farm manager, TransCanada showed up and said they'd like to have an easement across the farm. And there's lots of pipelines in the area, so my dad told them the same thing he told other pipelines. We don't want a pipeline. Can you find another route? Well, the other pipelines did. They went to our neighbors, a huge ranch just next to ours. But TransCanada said, no, we're coming across, and if you don't voluntarily take the offer that we make to you, we can take your land anyway, and then you'll get a whole lot less money than we originally offered. So we never once said we wanted more money. We had concerns about our water because this pipeline would go under the creek where we have water rights. We had concerns about the Caddo Indian artifacts that are all over our farm. And we just didn't want to give up control of land to anybody, especially a Canadian company transporting what they're going to transport. So we didn't sign their agreement. The final offer was $21,000. They did have the land condemned. We challenged that condemnation. We're saying a Canadian corporation building a for-profit pipeline does not have the right to take a Texan's land. They could have built their pipeline if they want to go around us as far. It wasn't a NIMBY, but we're challenging the taking of the land. And by staying in the game long enough, we've helped shine a light on this terrible process in Texas where, I mean, you could have the Jonathan, you know, McNamara pipeline by checking a box on a form and paying a fee, and then you get to pick up the Club of Eminent Domain. That's not what the founders of the Texas Constitution had in mind in 1917 when they designed eminent domain.
No. Yeah, I was going to say, I find that surprising that, you know, and I think a lot of people would find that surprising that a private company like that could come in and seize land. I mean, we've heard about governments kind of doing that and exercising eminent domain, but I think it's probably surprising to a lot of people that, especially in this state, a private company could come in and just seize someone's land without their permission. And yet you've kind of seen that happen firsthand. Were you yep. surprised by that?
Well, I was. And until this fight, I hadn't even, eminent domain had never been something in my mind. So, I can see how when you need to get water to a community or electricity to some town or build a road or something, that eminent domain, where you can prove that it benefits everybody, that it's a public use, and that it's not like it's some big money maker that's going to make shareholders happy and you're looking at your stock increase. That's basically what TransCanada's doing, is they're building a pipeline to put money in their pocket. And because the laws in Texas are basically the honor system, I mean, the honor system works when people behave honorably. So how interesting that the abuse of the system is happening by a foreign corporation coming into Texas. Now, they claim in my deposition, which is a six-hour interrogation, they claim that it was an American company that took our land because TransCanada registered a company in Delaware, which is like, getting married in Vegas. So it's the sad thing is it's taking a landowner like us to help peel away some of this rhetoric. The jobs aren't the job numbers that they threw out there. It's more than likely an export pipeline. The product they're transporting is not crude petroleum. That's what they have on their paperwork. But you know what, guys? Diluted bitumen sinks in water. It's full of hydrogen sulfide. They weren't fully transparent with that. So we're staying in the game long enough to help shine a light on what this monster really is. And yeah, we're knocking on the door of the Supreme Court, and we're feeling more and more confident they'll take our case on appeal. But we're also like a bad penny that won't go away. And I'm sure TransCanada wonders, why didn't we just go around that Crawford gal instead of plowing through her land?
Well, Julia, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.